Audiology is the study of hearing and balance. You don't hear in the ear, you hear in the brain. So much of audiology is now concerning itself with neuroscience and with neuroanatomy.
Audiologist Professor Robert Sweeto.
Well, probably the two most common causes for hearing loss would be noise exposure and the aging process. About 15% of people worldwide have tinnitus, which is really a tremendous number. The neuroplasticity really works in our favor in some things, but when it comes to tinnitus, it tends to kind of mess everything up because the brain is becoming more active looking for something it's not getting. There's 360 million people worldwide that have hearing loss, but by 2050, that number is going to double. And in terms of dementia, 50 million people worldwide have dementia. That number is expected to triple by 2050. Putting hearing aids on people, even if they have fairly mild hearing losses, as they get older, will help them slow the process of this cognitive decline. Tinnitus typically starts in the inner ear because of damage to the ear. But ultimately, what happens is that the brain is where the tinnitus is really coming from. And here's how we know that.
Hey there, friends. Welcome to the Happy Habit Podcast. I'm Matthew. You'll find me here every Monday and Thursday talking all things health, well-being, and self-improvement with many of the world's leading experts. So if that is your thing, you are in the right place. If you're already familiar with this podcast and you've not already done so today, please show your support. It is absolutely free and it'll take you 2 seconds. Please like, subscribe, and share with other people you think might enjoy these episodes too, and leave the podcast a positive rating. You can do that right now on iTunes and on Spotify. Talking of Spotify, I thought you needed to have Spotify Premium in order to be able to watch the videos of these episodes. That is not the case. So enjoy the videos there, or indeed over on YouTube, where you can become a subscriber too. Most of us have probably had an issue with our hearing at one point, be it ringing in the ears, hearing loss caused by an ear infection, or dizziness. And if you've not, odds on are you will likely experience an issue at some point in the future. So I'm keen to bring you a really insightful conversation with a man who knows a thing or two about our ears and who can help us with some terrific advice. I'm speaking today with a giant of the field of audiology, by the name of Robert Sweeto. He is a retired professor of audiology who worked at the Department of Otolaryngology and was former director of audiology at the University of California, San Francisco. We find out what audiology is and discover what the main components of the ear are, expect to find out the difference between hearing and listening, and that one of these happens in the ear while the other one doesn't. We talk about the main causes of hearing loss and how to avoid it. We learn shocking statistics that suggest hearing loss is a growing problem. I ask Professor Sweeto to explain exactly what tinnitus is and what treatments exist for it. We also explore the relationship between hearing loss and conditions of cognitive decline, such as dementia, and learn if we can control hearing loss, we can lessen our risk of cognitive decline. Professor Sweeto is fascinating to listen to. If you value your hearing, if you or indeed anyone you know suffers from hearing loss, tinnitus, or cognitive decline, this conversation is definitely worth checking out. Can you provide a brief overview, just to begin with, of what audiology is and why it's important for individuals listening and watching today to be aware of their auditory health?
Sure. Well, audiology is the study of hearing and balance. And so we concern ourselves with the measurement of hearing, the measurement of listening, which, again, as we talk this morning, will become pretty apparent that hearing and listening are not the same thing. Audiology has changed a lot since I began in it many, many, many years ago, because we really realize now that you don't hear in the ear, you hear in the brain. And so much of audiology is now concerning itself with neuroscience and with neuroanatomy and some of the disorders that we really focus on in addition to hearing loss are things like tinnitus with ringing in the ear, balance problems, things like that. And all of these things are related not simply to the ear, but they these disorders begin in the ear typically and then wind up being processed in the brain. And that's where so much of the work has to deal with it.
Well, can we contextualize this, first of all, from an anatomical standpoint, exactly how the ear is laid out and the main components of the ear that allow us to hear, but also to balance, as you mentioned a moment ago?
Okay, so the ear basically is comprised of an outer ear, a middle ear, and an inner ear. The outer ear is this thing that's much too big on me. When I was young, my brother used to ask him to drive me to school, and he used to say, well, why don't you fly to school? Because he thought my ears were so big. Not very nice. But so your outer ear basically is there just to collect sounds. And it's actually an effective little device, not as effective as it is in animals, because animals have all these extrinsic muscles that can move their ears around to help them localize where sound is coming from. Humans don't have that ability so well. But what these little auricles or pinnas do for us is they do help to collect high-frequency sounds. And this is one of the reasons why you see people go like this. And when you go like this, you're actually allowing the high frequencies to bounce off of your hand and into your ear. And it really does help you in that regard. So, I always used to think that people who have ears that kind of stick out like that are probably in great shape in terms of helping to collect some of those high frequencies. But that's about all the outer ear does, is it allows you to pick up these high frequency sounds. They then are sent from the outer ear into the ear canal, which is about, UK and Irish terms is 2.5 centimeters, about an inch, something like that long. And the sound waves travel into your ear canal. They hit your eardrum. Your eardrum vibrates. Attached to your eardrum, now we move to the middle ear, are three of the smallest bones in the body. And as the eardrum moves back and forth, these bones move back and forth. And the final bone, the bone closest inside, is called the stapes, or the stirrup, because it looks like a horse's stirrup. And as the eardrum moves back and forth, these three bones move back and forth, and they enter into the inner ear. And the inner ear is what we call the cochlea and the semicircular canals. So that's the portion that processes the incoming sound as these waves move your eardrum back and forth. The stapes, or the stirrup, pivots into the inner ear, into one of the windows in the inner ear. And as that happens, there's a membrane in the inner ear that moves up and down, and there's thousands of nerves attached to that membrane. It's called the basilar membrane. And as the basilar membrane moves up and down, it sends an electrical signal up the auditory nerve and into the brain. And then once it gets into the brain, it gets very complicated because, for example, most of the sounds coming into your right ear move over to the left side of your brain and vice versa for the left ear moving over to the right side of your brain. But then when you're processing language, it moves back to the left side of your brain. When you're processing music, it moves back to the right side of your brain. So it gets rather complicated. And also in the inner ear is this vestibular system that consists of these semicircular canals. And as you move your head either back and forth or to the side, though there's fluid that kind of sloshes through those semicircular canals. And that's what tells your brain what your location is, whether you're upright, whether you're sideways, whether you're slipping, how you're moving. And it's really a remarkable system. And if you want to know how remarkable it is, you think about somebody running down the field and kicking a soccer ball or catching a football pass, how remarkable it is that your head can be bouncing along like that, and yet you can keep a steady eyesight on whatever it is you're trying to kick or catch. So it's quite a remarkable system, and especially when you consider how small it is. It's a very tiny organ in the brain.
I can certainly attest to how remarkable it is from the point of view of balance, because I had an infection in my ear a few years ago, and I was diagnosed with vestibulitis or something like that. Yeah. And I was dizzy for several months. I was walking like I was drunk for several months. It corrected itself over time, but I had to be given exercises whereby I could retrain my brain again and then restore my balance. So I can attest to the importance of the inner ear when it comes to the maintenance of balance.
Yeah, and you just hit on something very important when you say you retrained your brain. Because that's something that I know we'll discuss in the next half hour or hour. That is a very important issue for adults in terms of retraining their brain when they have a hearing loss, both in terms of how they control or how they react to a constant ringing in their ears, or also just in terms of cognitive decline as we get older. We now know very, very clearly from a lot of research that untreated hearing loss leads to a significant increase in cognitive decline and even dementia. So, and retraining the brain is a possibility that becomes very, very important for us.
Well, I want to come to that, but first of all, can we look at some of the most common causes for hearing loss?
Okay. Well, probably the two most common causes for hearing loss would be noise exposure, and it's a noisy world out there, so noise exposure becomes very, very important, and the aging process is very important. But then in addition to that, there's all kinds of diseases, disorders that can cause hearing loss. When you're young, one of the connections between the ear and the nose is called the eustachian tube, and when you're very, very young, your eustachian tube is angled more horizontal than it is as we get older, and it becomes more vertically oriented. And so, because of that orientation, when you're young, kids get a lot of ear infections, and of course, fortunately, as you get older, a lot of these ear infections go away. The middle ear infections, at any rate. So that's a real common disorder in children, and it can be fixed either with antibiotics or, in more extreme cases, they put a little tube in the eardrum that kind of replaces the function of the eustachian tube. But in terms of losing your hearing through aging process, you've got somewhere between 30,000 and 50,000 little hair cells or little nerve cells in the ear that then, you know, send this signal up the auditory nerve into the brain and ultimately to the auditory cortex. And so when these hair cells are damaged, up to now, you haven't been able to do anything about it. Fortunately, now there's a lot of research going on in DNA and in different gene therapies that have a lot of promise in terms of regrowing these hair cells once they die, or once they're broken, if you will. So that's a really important thing. And of course, you know, hearing aids and cochlear implants, which kind of bypass, well, the cochlear implants kind of bypass damage to the inner ear. So that's an effective approach today. And of course, hearing aids are very important, and I'm sure we'll get into that a little bit later.
Is hearing loss inevitable as you get older? Is it just wear and tear as such? And then the hearing loss that you acquire as a result of age, does that manifest itself differently to hearing loss through exposure to loud noises? And I'm talking in the absence of tinnitus here.
Well, there's a few different ways of damage to the inner ear. And definitely there is somewhat of a difference. I mean, ultimately, once the inner these hair cells. You have outer hair cells and inner hair cells. And once these hair cells are damaged, their reaction is similar. But as you get older, regardless of any past exposure to noise, there is something called presbycusis, which is just an aging process. And this aging process simply breaks down the hair cells and the metabolism and the chemicals that help to transfer all the signals up to the brain. So there's somewhat of a difference in terms of how the hearing loss comes about, but there's not much of a difference in terms of anatomically. Once the hearing loss in the inner ear occurs, it's going to be similar. The cochlea is going to look, the cochlea or the inner ear is going to look similar in both cases. What will change, however, is your brain's ability to process a lot of these signals. If it's due to noise exposure and you're young, your certain areas of your brain can kind of compensate. As you get older, not only do you have the problem from the cochlea and the inner ear, but in addition, you just don't have the cognitive skills, which tend to decline regardless of having a hearing loss, but seem to get sped up when you do have a hearing loss. Those cognitive resources are not as available to you as an older person. And so the way the brain will process a hearing loss is different for an older person than it is for a younger person.
So would that inform then the method used to diagnose the hearing loss in the individual who presents with hearing loss?
Well, you know, it's interesting when you think of hearing loss, most people think of a loss of sensitivity, that they can't hear soft sounds. But that's just one small part of the hearing loss. In addition to the ability to hear soft sounds, it's the ability to have clarity, which we call discrimination or intelligibility. That's what really falls apart, particularly in older people. But with any kind of a hearing loss, we tend to lose our high frequencies first. And the high frequencies, the high pitches, are really essential for understanding speech. Because, the vowel sounds are primarily located in low frequencies. The consonant sounds are primarily located with the high frequencies. And so when you lose something like, and that's in certain languages like English, this is really the case. In Mandarin or Cantonese, it's a little bit different. There's more of an importance in the lower frequencies as well. But for English-speaking people, the high frequencies are critically important. And if you think about it, if you just take a sentence, any sentence, and you type it out or you read it, if you take out all of the vowels, you can still figure out what that sentence is. If you take out all the consonants, you're lost. And so when you lose your high frequencies, you're losing the ability to understand speech. And that's what becomes really critical.
It's interesting. You mentioned high frequencies there. I remember a few years ago, it made the news in the UK that to take advantage of the fact that younger people would be more predisposed to being able to hear higher frequencies, some of the shops in a particular area, I think it was in London, decided to use emitters of high frequencies in order to dissuade young people from loitering outside their shops. And I think they got into trouble, but it was a method for them in order to be able to disperse these people and get them away from the shops, because older people, just slightly older people in their 20s or 30s or 40s, weren't affected by the high-pitched frequency, so were able to go about their shopping without being discommoded, unlike the younger people who had to scarper because they didn't like the high-pitched noise. I don't know if you've heard that story before.
No, actually, I have heard that story. Yeah. And it's amazing to me, actually, that the military doesn't employ sound even more than, they do anyway, but it's amazing that they don't employ sound as a weapon more than they currently do.
Okay, so let's just revisit then the diagnosis then of hearing loss. How does somebody be diagnosed with hearing loss if they go to their audiologist, for example?
Okay, so you're going to get basically a hearing test where they put little insert earphones into your ear canals, and then sounds are presented, some low frequency, some mid frequency, some high frequency sounds, and the patient is instructed to just push a button or raise their hand whenever they hear a sound, and you gradually decrease the sound and you kind of bracket to determine exactly what is the softest sound a person could hear at the various frequencies. So that's one test that is done. Then tests are done to understand speech. So now these tests are done at a comfortable listening level for an individual to see how well they understand speech in quiet, and even more important, to see how well they can understand speech when there's a background noise. Because when there's a background noise, typically the background noise is in the low frequencies. And if a person has, most people with hearing loss, not all, but most people with hearing loss don't hear the high frequencies as well. So when you, and so they have to rely on the low frequencies, but then when there's a background noise, that tends to mask out the low frequencies. And it means that you have to rely on your high frequency hearing, which is impaired. So that's why people with a high frequency hearing loss tend to have so much difficulty hearing in noise.
What is the degree of accuracy of these audiology tests?
They're pretty accurate. They're pretty accurate. They're accurate within a few decibels. And so, you know, the thing is, again, there's been too much emphasis over the years on this ability to hear a soft sound, because we don't listen to soft sounds. We listen to sounds above our auditory threshold, typically. And so, you know, the ability to hear a sound at 0 decibels isn't as important as the fact that when we're talking right now, we're probably, you know, talking around 60 decibels. So when we, so when you test a person's ability to understand speech, it's essential that you can recognize that hearing is not linear or uniform throughout the intensity scale. You know, the ability, the fact that, and again, some people with hearing loss, for example, it seems paradoxical, but they say, oh, everything's too loud for me. Well, you think, how can it be too loud if you don't hear these soft sounds? And that's because when you have a hearing loss, it kind of compresses your auditory window, if you will, because you don't hear the low frequency sounds very well. They have to be made louder for you just to be able to hear them. But then when the sound gets loud enough that it would be, you know, clearly understandable, many people with hearing loss will say that's much too loud for me. And this is called loudness recruitment. And again, it has to do with the fact that you have these outer hair cells and you have these inner hair cells, and they each have a different function. So when you have a hearing loss, the first thing that goes are your outer hair cells, and their function is to process softer sounds. So if they're damaged, you don't hear the softer sounds. But then when the sound gets loud enough, it then starts to trigger these inner hair cells. And all of a sudden, the person will say, well, wait, that's just much too loud for me. So it becomes a tricky issue in terms of prescribing hearing aids and programming hearing aids to make sure that the soft sounds are audible, but that the loud sounds are not too loud.
Let's move to a subject I know that you're passionate about, and a subject many people will be unfortunately familiar with, including myself at one point a few years ago, and that is the subject of tinnitus. It characterizes itself in various different ways. It can be ringing in the ears, clicking, it can be buzzing. Can you tell us from an anatomical standpoint exactly what is happening in the ear? And I know this brings in communication then with the brain as well, because you were talking about neurology earlier. So could you just explain for us exactly what's going on in tinnitus?
So, and there's a lot of different theories. First of all, there's a lot of things that can cause hearing loss. There's a lot of things that can cause tinnitus as well. And so typically tinnitus is frequently associated with noise exposure. People my age, your age, that have gone to loud concerts and stuff very frequently have tinnitus. In fact, it supposedly there about 15% of people worldwide have tinnitus, which is really a tremendous number. People who are exposed to noise, like in the military, for example, more than 50% of soldiers coming back from a war zone have tinnitus. Fortunately, about maybe 1 or 2% of the individuals who have tinnitus are severely bothered by it. So tinnitus typically starts in the inner ear because of damage to the ear. But ultimately what happens is that the brain is where the tinnitus is really coming from. And here's how we know that. I was saying earlier that, you know, when we were talking about the pathway of sound through the outer ear and moving the middle ear muscle, middle ear bones, and then sending, triggering the response from these hair cells in the inner ear, which then sends the electrical signal up the auditory nerve and into the brain. Well, what happens is if you take somebody, and this used to be done like in the 1940s, if a person would go in with terrible tinnitus, they would go into the doctor, they would say, I can't stand this ringing in my ears. And the doctor would literally go in and do surgery and cut the auditory nerve. So they would essentially cut the connection between the ear and the brain. They would cut that connection off, figuring, well, now the person's not going to have tinnitus. The majority of the people that had that eighth nerve dissection woke up as deaf as my table, but still had tinnitus. And so that was the first indication that, wait a minute, regardless of where the tinnitus began, it's ultimately being processed in the brain. And it's very just the way it happens. Like we have a lot of data right now that shows that, for example, when you have a hearing loss, there's obviously less activity going on in the inner ear because the high frequencies can't, for example, and I keep saying the high frequencies, there are disorders such as Meniere's syndrome, which causes balance problems and tinnitus and low frequency hearing loss. So not everybody has a high frequency hearing loss. The reason I keep bringing it up is because it's just much more common, particularly in old people, but in anybody with noise exposure as well. So what happens with this, you have this hearing loss, let's say in the high frequencies. Now the high, your brain, they're in the ear, there's what we call a tonotopic arrangement. It's kind of similar to a piano keyboard, where you have your, you know, high pitches on your treble on one side, bass on the other side. And that's also how the inner ear works. There are certain hair cells that are, the hair cells that are closest to the base of the cochlea process high frequencies. The hair cells that are closest to the apex of the cochlea processes low frequencies. Now, so let's say you have a high frequency loss. Well, not only is there this tonotopic arrangement in the inner ear, but there's also a tonotopic arrangement in the auditory cortex in your brain. Well, when you have damage to the neurons in your ear, that does not mean you have damage to the neurons in your brain. So this is kind of a simplified explanation, but essentially what happens is the brain is expecting to get this high frequency stimulation. And when it doesn't get it, it begins to turn up its sensitivity to look for the signal it's not receiving. And we know this because you could actually electrically measure what is going on. As a person has a hearing loss, there's less activity in the auditory nerve because the high frequencies are not being processed. But then in the brain, there's actually more activity for those nerves. And to, on top of all of that, what happens is when you have a hearing loss, the organization, this tonotopic organization, literally changes so that the, since you're not getting high frequency stimulation, the nerves that should be processing the high frequencies begin to process the mid frequencies, which you can hear. So everything gets changed around. The whole the brain gets completely reorganized. And this is also part of what is called neuroplasticity. And the neuroplasticity really works in our favor in some things. But when it comes to tinnitus, it tends to kind of mess everything up because the brain is, you know, is becoming more active looking for something it's not getting.
So it's overcompensation by the brain. It's looking for those frequencies it's not getting. So it's creating those frequencies, and that's what we're hearing in our heads.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. I mean, it's really not a sound that we're getting in our head. It's really electrical activity in the brain that is reacting to that. And when that electrical activity in the brain starts to become hypersensitive, it then releases certain neurotransmitters, and all the parts of the brain function together. So, you know, while your temporal lobe, where your auditory cortex is, might be responsible for hearing, there are connections between that part of your brain and the middle of your brain where is located what is called the limbic system, the amygdala, which is responsible for emotions, and then the hippocampus, which is responsible for memories. So all of these things begin to work together, and the brain creates kind of a defense mechanism that says, wait a minute, what the brain perceives as a sound, but is actually this electrical activity. The brain will say, that shouldn't be there. There's no sound coming in from outside, so why am I hearing something? And so the brain begins to change a lot of activity. Normally, and I might be getting ahead of myself here, but normally what happens is there's kind of a gating mechanism in the brain that would say important sounds should be passed on to the auditory cortex and then to the frontal lobe so that they're processed and so that they have some meaning. And that's what normally should occur. But when you get something like tinnitus, the brain may say, well, this perception is keeping me from sleeping. It's making me very nervous. And the brain begins to focus on this signal that it thinks is dangerous. You know, this is similar to when you think about things like your brain normally suppresses signals that it doesn't think are important. You don't feel the ring on your finger, the clothing on your body. You don't feel when you're sitting in a chair, you don't feel your rear end sitting in the chair. But if somebody alerts you to it, you can't get your mind off of it. Similarly, if you're walking down a dark street in a dangerous neighborhood, normally we don't even hear our own footsteps when we're walking down the street because our brain suppresses the signal because they know it's supposed to be there. But let's say somebody's walking behind you in this dark alley. Your brain will focus on that because it theoretically represents some kind of danger. And so the brain will focus on that. And it really, it creates a terrible sensation in your emotionally and from a memory perspective. And I used to tell my patients who would say, you know, especially if a patient would come in with their spouse or with their partner, and their partner would say, I just don't understand how this could be so annoying to my spouse. And I would point out, if you think about it, like think about if you're driving down the street and all of a sudden you see police lights flashing behind you, what happens to you? Your heart starts pounding really fast. You get this release of adrenaline. You get this, all these neurochemicals are released. Your hands start to sweat. Your heart is pounding. But then as soon as the police car passes you by, very quickly, you go back to a normal state. But for the person who has tinnitus and for the person who is very bothered by their tinnitus because they believe it represents either a danger like a brain tumor or they're going deaf, which they, does not mean, you know, really has no basis. But for that person, they're always in that hyper state that, you know, for the, that you would be in with the police car behind you. So it's really a very difficult situation for a person who has tinnitus to be able to ignore it unless they're able to reconceptualize the importance or lack of importance of the tinnitus.
So there's a psychological component, really. Their perception of their tinnitus and their condition can exacerbate their lived experience of it and make it even worse because they're so constantly focused on something that seems to always be there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, when you say it is a psychological component, but I like to really explain it as really even more of a physical component because of these changes, these occurrences in the brain. And so, because I would never want my patient to think that, oh, I'm psychologically weak and that's why I can't deal with the tinnitus. There are actually physical changes that occur in your brain that really do function as kind of a defense mechanism. And, you know, and there's chemicals released that some will inhibit, some will excite. It gets all messed up when you have this perception of something that doesn't belong there. So it's not really a matter of psychological weakness, but it's really, and this, you know, really leads into the whole treatment of tinnitus, that a lot of it has to do with education, counseling, helping a patient reconceptualize the importance or lack of importance of that signal. Because, you know, just like, again, the way I was saying, sitting in your chair, you could feel your rear end in your chair right now. But over time, you don't think about it because it's not important. But every time I would bring it up, you would really focus on it.
In addition to reframing then how you see and how you experience your tinnitus, can we talk about some of the newer treatments? Because I know one was developed here in Ireland, which involves that brain retraining and that neuroplasticity that you were talking about. I don't know if you're familiar with this. This involves retraining the perception of tinnitus using electrical signals by a probe on the tongue. Have you heard of this?
Yes. Yes, absolutely, I have. And as a matter of fact, I not so long ago, I met with the guy from Ireland that was working on it and also a guy from the University of Minnesota who's working on these things together. And there are now actually two or three devices out there that are using bimodal or bisensory stimulation to try to help somebody. And the whole concept is that you're going to kind of create a conditioned response between stimulation of one sense. In the case of the tongue, you know, a person just wears this device for, I think, 20 minutes a day. And it's coupled or it's paired with a sound like your tinnitus so that eventually your brain will habituate to it. So there have been a number, the bisensory or bimodal stimulation devices that are out there. One of them, like I say, works on the tongue. Another one works with a stimulation of the neck. And it's still early in the game to decide how effective these are. They certainly are showing some good initial results. But, you know, in addition to that, the education, the counseling, particularly something called cognitive behavioral therapy, which is what I used to really focus on in my practice. Cognitive behavioral therapy was brought about for people with chronic pain. And if you think about it, chronic pain and chronic tinnitus are similar. They're both invisible. They're both very subjective. Some people completely ignore it. Some people are terribly bothered by it. And that's regardless of how loud it seems in your brain. There's not a strong correlation between the loudness of the tinnitus and how badly you're bothered by it. Some people have tinnitus that's pretty soft, but they can't stop listening to it. And other people have tinnitus that's pretty loud, and they're able to ignore it. So the cognitive behavioral therapy kind of is addressing this, the limbic system. It's kind of trying to teach you to not allow negative thoughts to make your brain focus on the tinnitus and make your amygdala release chemicals because it's emotionally disturbing to you. So that's one of the approaches. Hearing aids are helpful for people with tinnitus, and they're helpful for people with tinnitus simply because, just as I'm saying that tinnitus occurs because of a lack of stimulation from the inner ear, this provides more stimulation to the inner ear by increasing the amplitude of the incoming signal. And so the brain does not have as much of a need to turn up its sensitivity or turn up its gain to look for the signals, because now the hearing aids are reinserting some of those high frequency signals back into your brain.
I'm wondering then, will artificial intelligence then facilitate the development of technologies that can mask the tinnitus that we're talking about?
I think artificial intelligence is going to have a huge effect on so many aspects. I'm not exactly sure how it's going to work with tinnitus. I know that I've been working for many years on an auditory training program for people with hearing loss. And now this whole training program is being redone. It's a training program called LACE, Listening and Communication Enhancement. And the program right now is in the process of being completely redone, artificial intelligence, so that there's going to be some amazing skills in terms of training that could be done that we couldn't even have imagined some years ago. I think that there will be, in terms of tinnitus, I think there will be, in terms of hearing loss, all kinds of impact from artificial intelligence that will be, you know, very, very useful.
Talk to me more about LACE, because you preempted my next question. LACE is an acronym. Could you just give us more details on this?
Yeah. So, you know, I had been in practice as an audiologist for, you know, 30 years or something like that. It always amazed me how limited some of the benefit from very good hearing aids would be for some people. And again, it's because we don't process speech in our ear. That's all that is a funnel to get that signal up to the brain. We process it in the brain. So there's a huge difference between listening and hearing. And that's why LACE is an acronym for Listening and Communication Enhancement. As we get older, not only do we have this tendency to have hearing loss, but we have more limited cognitive resources to process what really is becoming a distorted signal. You know, if your image right now on this camera were very fuzzy, well, your brain would still be able to kind of look past that fuzziness and still see exactly what's going on with you. But as we get older, we have, number one, the tendency to have a slower speed of processing, and speech occurs very, very rapidly. I think it's 120 to 180 words a minute in speech. So if your brain is not processing quickly and you're missing part of the signal because you have a hearing loss, now your brain has to work extra hard, and it has to work even more exertion on your brain in a noisy environment. And so again, this creates too much of a load on your cognitive abilities. And as we get older, our brain just doesn't handle that very well. So the idea behind LACE was to help a person in terms of focusing their whatever they have left to them in terms of hearing, but to teach them basically how to listen, to teach them to try to not be distracted by noises that are not relevant to the speech, to help them with their memory recall, their attention. So it's really their executive function, their ability to focus on what's important and ignore what's not important. And all of those things tend to decrease almost automatically as we get older. And then when you have the hearing loss on top of that, it makes it even more difficult for those remaining cognitive resources to function properly. And again, that's why there's so much research now that says that, you know, putting hearing aids on people, even if they have fairly mild hearing losses, as they get older, will help them slow the process of this cognitive decline.
Well, it's interesting, just following on from that, researching this interview, I happened upon a paper published, or a study published by Johns Hopkins, and it was over a 12-year period looking at about 600 people, and they showed the hearing loss really accelerated brain atrophy leading to that cognitive decline that you were talking about.
Yeah, that's very true. A fellow by the name of Frank Lim has done just tremendous research in that area. And again, you know, you think, and I've read statistics that talk about the, you know, how many people have dementia and cognitive. I mean, right now, they say that there's three, and these were just some statistics I had written out. There's 360 million people worldwide that have hearing loss. But by 2050, that number is going to double because people are living older, because the world is noisier. So that number, it people believe, will double. And in terms of dementia, there's right now, it says 50 million people worldwide have dementia. That number is expected to triple by 2050 because, again, as you know, we're getting older and there's a lot more demands on people in terms of what goes on. And as you have a hearing loss, you know, it not only does it make it more difficult to get all the information you need so that you don't have to overload your brain thinking about what is going on. But there are, you know, there's the social interference. You don't hang out with other people. You don't want to be around anybody else. You become more isolated. So you're not hearing, you're not listening. You become depressed. It's more fatiguing. So all of these things enter into the picture and create a system, like a perfect storm of hurting your brain because of your hearing loss. And it is so important to recognize, again, that listening and hearing are not the same thing. We hear in our ear, we listen in our brain. And that's where you really have to kind of understand. You know, I used to talk about the fact that, for example, back then I had normal hearing. Now I'm getting, you see, my hair is old, is gray, and now my hearing's not so great anymore. And I wear hearing aids actually. But when my hearing was normal, I could hear just fine. But if I was listening to somebody speaking Spanish that I have a rudimentary knowledge of, it really created more of a strain on my brain. I couldn't process it fast enough. So my listening ability for Spanish was just not very good. You know, you have to, you know, because first you have to hear it, then you have to pay attention to it, then you have to understand it. And so all of those things just weren't there. My hearing was there, but my understanding wasn't. So again, it kind of comes back into the play that listening and hearing are different, and communication skills become so essential in that chain as well, because, you know, a lot of people with hearing loss, if you say something to me and I didn't understand it because I have, let's say, a high frequency hearing loss, it doesn't do me any good to say to you, oh, would you repeat that, please? Because you're going to repeat it, and the same sounds that I didn't hear in the first place, I'm not going to hear in the second place. So I would be better off using communication skills like saying, I'm sorry, could you slow down just a little bit on that? And, or could you rephrase that? Because now I'm going to get more information into my brain that will help compensate for what I didn't get from my ears.
Are you alluding there, when you mentioned communication, are you alluding to a functional communication assessment, which I know you were instrumental in coming up with also?
Yes, I think that, again, you know, it's really important to assess for the patient, again, not just what they can hear, but what they can't hear is really essential, and how they're going to process it. I wrote a paper a million years ago that I think the only person who, I put it in the wrong journal, so I think the only person who actually read this paper was my mother, and she thought it was a pretty good paper, and she didn't understand a word of it, but it was a paper about something called the communication confidence profile. And so it kind of looked at, well, what are you going to do when you don't understand something? Will you just kind of drop out of that conversation? How will you get back into the conversation? And it basically was assessing how confident are you in terms of your ability to rearrange the situation. You know where to sit in a restaurant if you're wearing hearing aids that have these directional microphones that focus on what's in front of you. You realize that, well, you want to sit with your back to the wall, and so that your face is facing towards where the sound is coming from, or put your back towards there's my cognitive resources are blocking right there. You're putting your back towards the kitchen so that you don't hear all of the noise that's going on. So it's a matter of assessing, what does a person know? How do you get them to learn to pay attention more, understand the difference between listening and hearing, and then use their brain and their communication strategies to put themselves in an ideal situation?
Okay, so we've been talking about some fairly stark statistics looking into the future. People watching and listening to this episode today in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and age-related hearing loss might not be a factor quite yet, but let's talk about prevention. How can people prevent themselves becoming a statistic later on, whereby they suffer from extreme hearing loss and or cognitive decline?
Well, obviously, they can't do much in terms of stopping the medical or the physical process of aging, but they certainly can limit their noise exposure. You know, today everybody's walking around with headphones and AirPods and things like that. And interestingly enough, in fact, I was involved in a case many, many years ago where when Apple first came out with their not the iPhone, but like the iPad,
the iPod.
What was it called? The iPod. Yes, the iPods. When they first came out with the iPods, they had no limit on how loud you could turn it up in the United States. I think in the UK, they had a limiter on there, which was interesting. And then people were, talking about suing them in the United States. Why don't you have a limiter? Now they do. So now they, parents could set the limit for how loud this should be. And, we used to always tell patients, if you're putting headphones on and somebody standing next to you could hear the music, it's way too loud. So, and the other problem is that headphones or the things that we're using nowadays to listen through music sound so good that you crank up the volume. Years ago, if you cranked up the volume with these old bulky headphones, you'd reach a point where the music would be distorting. And so you'd turn down the volume. Well, now the music doesn't distort. So kids will have a tendency, or adults will have a tendency, to keep cranking up the volume to a point where it becomes dangerous for their ears. Once this happens and the hair cells are damaged, there's a real problem unless... research, and again, you said people in their 30s. I'm guessing, I'm like in my 70s. I'm not going to be around for hair cell regeneration. But I'm going to guess that people in their 30s, by the time they're 70, there will be all kinds of genetic strategies that will allow them to regenerate these hair cells in their inner ear that will help them.
Just on that subject of earphones, I know there's a newer generation of earphone now, which actually they don't go into the ears, but they are resting on the bones. They work via conduction of the bones. What are your thoughts on these?
Well, first of all, bone conduction is a means of hearing that there's actually one of the things that we test in an audiology booth. We test how well you hear through your ear canals versus how well you could hear when the signal is sent through your bone. And because in both cases, you know, when it goes through your ear canals, it has to go through the outer ear and the middle ear to get to the inner ear. When you stimulate on the bone, the mastoid bone, it goes directly to your inner ear by literally shaking your skull. You don't feel it, but it literally is vibrating your skull, which vibrates the cochlea, which sends this wave into motion that sends the signal up to your brain. So you need, first of all, you need more pressure, more power to stimulate through the bone than you do through the ear. The ear has it, and the middle ear is the reason for this. It has what's called a transform function, which allows you to take a very small signal and magnify it by the time it gets to your inner ear. So when you stimulate through the bone, you do need more intensity to get the same sensation. But beyond that, I just wonder about the quality of that signal. Is it going to be as good? I sort of doubt it. That's why we have an outer, you know, our outer ear canal itself increases the intensity getting to the eardrum just by the shape of it. So it's a resonance, kind of like, you know, like blowing into a bottle. You get a certain resonance, and the ear canal has its own natural resonance, which enhances the signal reaching the inner ear. Going through bone conduction, I don't see how that's going to correct for that. So I don't know how well that's going to work. You know, I mean, it's great to be able to leave the ear open, but you know, I just am not real confident about the bone conduction signals.
One final question, Dr. Sweeto, before I let you go. It's been a really interesting discussion so far. Do you think people overlook their auditory health? Do you think people don't value it enough? That is, until they have a problem and have to go and see somebody like yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we really value our visual health. You know, people always, if you ask the average person on the street, what would you rather be, blind or deaf? Most people will say, I'd rather be able to see than hear. But if you ask somebody with a hearing loss, they're going to say, no, hearing loss is more devastating than a visual, than blindness, because hearing is for communication. Blindness isn't. And so, you know, that's part of the whole idea that you're right, that people just don't value. People are smart enough to not look into the sun. Well, not everybody. I mean, our former president during an eclipse was looking right at the sun because he thinks that he's immune to everything. But I guess I shouldn't get into politics here. And of course, you know, actually our two guys running for president in the United States right now, both of them have not only some hearing issues, I'm sure, but definitely have some cognitive issues as they're coming through with all their speeches these days. But at any rate, yeah, people know not to look into the sun. They don't think twice about being exposed to loud noises. And so you're absolutely correct that we don't value our auditory health as well as we value our visual health.
If people wanted to find out more about this subject, do you know of any resources that they can go to online where they can investigate a little more?
Well, you know, there's a lot. I mean, there's a real lot. Like, for example, in the UK, the British Tinnitus Association is a really good source. Here in the United States, we have the American Tinnitus Association. There's the British Academy of Audiology. I know I've spoken at that in the past. You know, nowadays with the internet, you can ask just about any question you want to know, although I used to tell my patients, please don't go on support groups for tinnitus, because all you're going to hear are people complaining about why they can't deal with it. But I mean, still, I think the internet is a valuable resource to look up noise noise reduction and noise protection and things like that. And, you know, and again, I do encourage anybody who walks away from a concert and or listening to through their earphones and they're finding a little bit of ear, should alert you that while that may be a permanent situation for you, it should alert you that it has caused some kind of reaction in the inner ear, and it should be a warning signal to you to, you know, control what's coming in.
Well, there you go. Common sense advice, certainly something I think my mother told me in years past. I think everybody's parents have probably told their children to do the same thing, but yes, I think we need to listen to sound advice. Plenty of it in this discussion today. I love talking with you. Thank you so much for taking the time, Professor Robert Sweeto.
Thank you for inviting me. This was lots of fun.
Well, thank you for tuning into this episode of the Happy Habit Podcast. If you liked it, or indeed any of the previous almost 400 episodes at this stage, please show your support. It'll take you 2 seconds and cost you absolutely nothing. Please like, subscribe, share with other people who you think might enjoy this content, and leave the podcast a positive rating. Until next time, stay happy.